Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, standing with all Californians as we address the coronavirus emergency together, on the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, it's Dolores Huerta's 90th birthday. We talk to the civil rights leader about her legacy. And writer Mark Arax tells us why novelist and playwright William Saroyan is relevant right now. But first, with the COVID-19 crisis, many medical facilities are critically low on supplies, including protective surgical masks. FM89's news director Alice Daniel reports that one answer to finding masks for Fresno's hospitals lies in a Chicago company that makes puppy pee pads.
Even before the coronavirus, Tiffany Quinto had some experience with pandemics.
You know, I lived through H1N1. I was a buyer at the time at Valley Children's, and it's similar to that.
Now she's the contract coordinator for community medical centers. She says medical supply distributors operate on an allocation system based on a hospital's previous purchase history.
So let's say community medical center would order 500,000 masks a month, and that was our steady amount. That's what we would be allotted now.
The benefit of the system is that everyone at least gets something.
Like what we saw with H1N1, where a lot of facilities bulk buying as many masks as they possibly could. So then that left a lot of healthcare systems without anything.
But it also means in a pandemic, she has to figure out ways to get more masks.
And that's where these third-party suppliers like Alan Cook come in.
Alan Cook lives in Chicago.
Hi, is this Alan?
This is. Are you this?
He didn't know a thing about medical masks before COVID-19.
So we make pet products.
And not just any pet product. Cook made a deal on the TV show Shark Tank for his electronic self-cleaning indoor dog potty called Brilliant Pad. It uses puppy pads that small dogs can pee or poop on when their owners are away, and it automatically rolls up the used one and rolls out a fresh one. Those rolls of puppy pads, they're made at a factory in China that also makes diapers and hygiene products. And Cook has a good relationship with his supplier.
So they called us a week or two ago saying there was a knock at their door.
The knock at the door? The Chinese government, telling the factory to repurpose some of its equipment to make medical masks. So all of a sudden, Cook had this pipeline to masks. He reached out to friends who work in healthcare just to see if they needed any. The response was huge. So he put his day job on hold, created a new company called Chicago PPE.
Hello, Chicago PPE.
That stands for Personal Protective Equipment.
And instead of monitoring production of our stuff, we've temporarily paused it, and we're contributing our resources to making these masks.
The first day he put up his website, he processed orders for 170,000 masks. That was 2 weeks ago. Now the orders have long passed 2 million.
It's just chaos. You can probably hear the phone in the background. The phone is like ringing literally nonstop.
And there have been plenty of complications, from banking challenges to Cook's greatest source of stress, transportation. There's no cargo availability on passenger planes, so few are flying. UPS is backed up.
We were told that UPS is not taking new orders.
And now Cook has shifted to shipping the mask out of Hong Kong using DHL. Well, at least for now.
I won't be surprised if we're talking a few days from now and saying, and there's another method.
Cook says he's never worked so hard in his life. He's enlisted family and friends to volunteer. Sometimes emotions run high. But he says everyone's kind of taking a deep breath, knowing
whatever stress we're experiencing is nothing compared to what the people in the hospitals in front of patients are dealing with.
Including doctors and nurses back at community medical centers, where Tiffany Quinto works. When Cook reached out to his friends in healthcare, well, one of them was in Fresno. That's how Quinto even found out about him. So she started the vetting process. The first requirement, FDA certification.
Then I send it over to our COVID-19 command center.
Doctors reviewed the samples last week, and it turns out the mask that came from a factory in China via a Shark Tank entrepreneur who makes a puppy pad product, well, an order was just placed for $250,000. The first shipment should arrive in about a week. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Alice Daniel.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Dolores Huerta, the labor leader and civil rights activist who co-founded the United Farm Workers with Cesar Chavez, turns 90 today. It's also the second official Dolores Huerta Day in the state of California. Her work as a community organizer and advocate has led to numerous awards. In 2012, President Obama gave her the Presidential Medal of Freedom. She has honorary degrees from Princeton, Mills, and the University of the Pacific. She even has an asteroid named in her honor. Earlier this week, I had the opportunity to talk with Huerta about her life and legacy. I'd like to start out by talking a bit about your past and your legacy. You know, you started as a grassroots organizer and continue to be one today through your work with the Dolores Huerta Foundation. Why do you continue to believe in the power of organizing to affect change, particularly at this moment of such great political division and cynicism?
Well, because it works. I think that's the simple answer. We do know that when people do get engaged and when they do, see what improvements they need in the community, and then they commit themselves to take positive action to improve the community, that miracles happen. And once that they know that they're the ones that are actually responsible for the improvements, then it really, they kind of get hooked for life, that they want to stay engaged. And so it's beautiful because this is exactly what democracy is about. You know, we really can't have a democracy unless people engage at the local level, at the state level, and the national level. And so it's very exciting. It always makes me feel really great when I'll have someone say to me, I didn't know I could do this. You know, because they don't realize, a lot of people don't realize how important they are in order to make our democracy work. And once they do get engaged, it's like it opens doors for them and they get a sense of their own worth, that they get a sense of their own power. And so it's just amazing to see this happen to individuals.
What's a moment of activism in your life that you will never forget? And why does it resonate so loudly for you?
Well, I think there are so many of those moments. But I think I remember growing up as a teenager and, you know, like a lot of young Latinos and Latinas, you know, always having to face the constant discrimination that we had to face growing up, not only in our schools, but in the community, and police harassing us all of the time. You know, just when we were coming home from a basketball game or a football game, and to be getting stopped and searched, and then you have all this anger that just builds up in you, but there's no outlet for the anger. And that once that you know that you can speak up and you can stop this kind of practices, then it makes you feel like that you can actually make something happen. So, my great awakening was the once when, and I did a TED talk on this, by the way, but when I took a man down to the local welfare department because he had suffered a stroke, and he was working in the field. It was a hot day, and he suffered a stroke, and so he was totally paralyzed on one side and was walking with a crutch. And when we tried to get him some disability assistance, and I went down there to put an application, they wouldn't let him make the application. And, so Fred Ross, who was the man that taught us how to organize, and I went and I said to Mr. Ross, they won't let this man make an application. And he said to me, you go down there to that agency, to that welfare office, and you demand to see a supervisor. And I thought, I can do that? And he said, yes, you could. But he didn't say, I'm going to call ahead or I'm going to go with you. He said, you go down there and you demand to see a supervisor. And of course I did, with a lot of butterflies in my stomach and a lot of anxiety. And I demanded to see the supervisor. And he came out and I said, this man is disabled and they won't let him make an application. And he said, well, they had to let him make an application because that was the law. Then I found out afterwards that they were doing this to a lot of the Latinos, just discouraging them, you know. And so that was a big victory, you know, in my mind, it was a big victory, especially for that family. So that, I think that is when you realize that you can actually make a big difference just by speaking out and by taking action and by not being afraid to speak out, knowing that you have rights.
Throughout your career, you often found yourself in situations where you were the only woman and the only person of color. I'm wondering, what did you learn from those experiences, and what advice do you have for young women today who may find themselves in similar situations?
Well, I was very fortunate in the advice that my mother gave me growing up. And one thing she said to me, never be afraid to be yourself, you know. Just you don't have to pretend that you're somebody else. Just pretend that you're yourself. And the other thing, and she told me, don't be afraid to speak out. Even if sometimes when we speak out, you make a mistake. But that's okay, because mistakes can always be corrected. But, you know, and so often when I would find myself, with very important people, I just felt confident because I thought, well, I don't have to pretend I'm anybody else than who I am. And just to be myself, and I think I made it very possible for me. With the chauvinist thing, the male chauvinist thing, for many years, I really didn't know how to handle that because my mother was racist. She and my father divorced, so she was the prominent figure in our family. And I always, looked up to my mother to be the leader and the decision maker. And so I had to kind of tap down a little bit, and for a long time, I really didn't know how to challenge the chauvinism that I was experiencing, I think as many women do daily. And so I had to kind of go back and read these books and think about how I was going to challenge this. And one of the things, of course, that we learned is that you don't have to act like the men. You know, you just have to learn how to, bring it to their attention when they're actually acting in a chauvinist manner. And always try to take credit for the work that you do so that others don't steal your work from you or take credit for your work. And that, again, takes a lot of courage, I think, for women. Because we as women, we're so used to being supportive and advocating for our husbands, our brothers, our sons, and not advocating for ourselves. So I think that's a lesson that I had to learn. But I had to read a lot of support books for women to be able to really understand what was going on.
You've been very honest about the sexism that you experienced as part of the United Farm Workers movement and throughout your career. Can you speak to some of your experiences and how they may inform your thoughts about the Me Too movement that we're living through right now?
Well, one of the first things I decided I was going to just stand up and challenge the sexism in the organization is that every time that they would make a sexist remark, I would make a little jot on my paper and so then I would bring it to their attention. And once I brought it to their attention, then they started realizing that they were making sexist remarks. Before that, I think they just thought it was just a natural thing to do. The other thing was, when I was doing my projects, I made sure that I had my project in place, what I was going to be doing, so that nobody could get in my way and stop the work that I was doing. So it took some planning. And it's interesting, when men do that, it's called planning. When women do it, it's called scheming. But again, I think as women, we just we do not need to be afraid of how they categorize or what they name the work that we do, as long as we know that what we're doing is sincere and we're doing it for the right reasons and trying the work that we do is helpful to others, then I think we just have to learn how to stand on our own 2 feet. And sometimes it's called ignoring of the sexist behaviors that are going on, but other times also we have to confront them and call out to people and say, and I can give you an example. We had one of our vice presidents once that gave this beautiful report of the work that he had done in New York. And luckily I was speaking after him. And so when I got up to my turn to speak, I said, no, I said, I just want to clarify that the report that this person just gave is actually the work that I did. Of course, he was very upset afterwards. He said, well, why did you do that? I said, well, why are you trying to take credit for my work? And so sometimes that we as women, and we have to think of different scenarios to do that. Sometimes we just have to do it privately and say to somebody, do you realize that the remarks that you're making are sexist and they are demeaning to women? And sometimes we have to do what I call an instant education, as I did with that other vice president of the union.
So I'd like to get some of your perspective on things that are happening currently in the world during these very unsettled times. You know, it was just last year that you were arrested at a Fresno County Board of Supervisors meeting while protesting for increased wages for in-home caregivers. Now, in light of COVID-19, you know, we're hearing reports that these workers are facing significant health risk as they provide care to people without access to proper protective gear to protect themselves. What would you like to see the government do to protect in-home caregivers?
Well, I think it's more than the home caregivers. When you look at all of the county workers, so many of them that are having to continue to work. And of course, when I was arrested because they were trying to get a wage increase for those workers. And they did get a wage increase, but not really the kind of a wage increase that they should be getting. And I think that's one of the problems that we have in our society is all of those workers that are invisible to us because they're the ones that are our support systems and they're not recognized, they're not taken care of. And I think that when we think of our frontline workers that are defending us right now in this crisis that we're in, you know, of course, the doctors and the nurses, and I have a son who's a doctor, I have a daughter who's a nurse, and the firefighters and you know, the police officers. But then we have all these other people like the county workers that you mentioned right now and the home care workers that also need to be protected. And then there's one other group that people are forgetting to mention entirely, and that is the farm workers. The farm workers are out there working every single day right now, you know, picking our food so that we can continue to eat. And yet people don't think about them. They don't even mention the farm workers and the people in the packing sheds, you know, because we have to continue to be producing the food to keep us healthy and alive during this whole pandemic that we're going through. Now, I say that so many of those workers are not being protected. And this, you might say that this negligence comes from the very top, from our federal government. It also is in our local governments, but they're not even mentioned in any of the news reports that you hear. I mean, I saw this wonderful report on Sunday morning about people doing victory gardens, okay? Yes, it's wonderful. We should all do victory gardens. But at the same time, there's thousands and maybe a million farm workers out there that are working right now every single day while everybody is, being able to stay home or having to stay home. And yet those workers are out there every day working.
Yeah, that was my follow-up question to you was, could you just speak to how vulnerable farm workers are at this moment?
Well, one good thing, you might say they're working on the outside, but at the same time, in many of the jobs that they're doing, they do have to be in close proximity, but they're not being provided masks at all. They have to ride to work. You know, the many farm workers have to take themselves to work, and they have to ride in cars maybe with four or five or six people or in vans. They might have 10 or 12 people in a van. And so there's no social distancing that is going on the way to work. And there have been farm workers, by the way, that have contracted the virus at this point in time. And people are not even aware that they're the ones that are being infected and affected by the virus.
What can the public do to keep farm workers in mind, to help protect their safety? Do you have any wisdom for what we can do to show our solidarity in light of this pandemic?
Well, I think there's two things we can do. One of them is that we can contact our governor, Gavin Newsom, who we know is doing an incredible job of keeping the public informed and trying to keep the public safe, to say not to forget the farm workers when they are giving out any of the economic relief that's going to be handed out to people. I've heard that the growers have gotten something like, the employers have gotten something like $12 billion in the stimulus package that was passed by the U.S. Congress. The other thing, and not only just thinking about farm workers here in California, but, you know, farm workers throughout the United States of America, besides California and Hawaii, do not even get unemployment insurance. Now, they are going to be drafting a fourth package to present Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, is now drafting a fourth package that's going to be presented to the Congress, and they could include any type of unemployment insurance for farm workers as part of that package. That would be really great. And again, increasing the amount of state monies that are going to be going to our families that live in deep poverty. I mean, here in the San Joaquin Valley, when we think about we are the agricultural producers of the nation in parts of the world. And we have this rich agricultural industry, but at the same time, we have the deepest poverty, especially for children here in the San Joaquin Valley, than anywhere in the United States of America. And that is so sad when we think how wealthy our agricultural industry is, and yet how poor the farm workers are.
And what, to your mind, should be done to fix the immigration system?
Well, it's a very simple solution. And that is simply one of the best things to do. Well, two things. I think immediately, because of what's happening with the virus, people can ask, we said write to our congresspeople and write to the governor to say that many of the people that are right now in detention centers should be released. Because when you have people there that were, many of them are vulnerable, many of them have reasons that they might be get a death sentence from the virus because they have diabetes or they have other health issues, that they should be released immediately. And there have been judges now. I think there was one in Pennsylvania, and there was another judge, I think maybe in Chicago or somewhere, that are ordering the release of many of these undocumented people. And the other thing that we can do is say, again, undocumented people need to be given some type of relief of the ones that are here in our country right now. And, of course, the final solution is to finally grant people legal status in this country, which is something that we have done from day one. You know, when our first immigrants came to the United States, to our country, they were legalized, and that has always been the policy of the United States of America, and stop this constant attack on our immigrants. But legalization is definitely the final solution for that. And it's something that needs to be done as soon as possible.
So I'd like to switch gears a bit and go back to the work that you're doing with your foundation. And what I find so interesting is that you really have taken an intersectional approach to the work, combining movements like labor rights, LGBTQ rights, civil rights, women's rights, immigrant rights. Why do you think it's so important that these movements work collaboratively to affect change?
Well, if we lump them all together, I think there's just one category, and it's called human rights. And we should just end all the discriminations and oppression of all peoples. And so many of these issues are just divisive issues, you know, when they attack women because women are fighting for their reproductive rights, or LGBTQ people that are fighting for their rights to marry. I mean, these are just divisive issues. And when we think about some of these issues, it's, they have this great saying in Spanish, respecting other people's rights is peace. This is the same from one of our great presidents, Benito Juarez, in Mexico. And we just respect other people's rights to exist, and that they should have all of the opportunities. People should not be denied opportunities because they're women or because they're gay. You know, people of color. I mean, that's ridiculous. So, you know, we have to get rid of some of these. I call them, in a way, false issues. These are just issues that are used by politicians to divide people. And we should not be divided. We can see right now in this crisis that we're in that We have to respect each other. We have to take care of each other. But as the saying has been said many times, that we're all in this together. We're all on this planet together also. So, you know, we should not be letting ourselves be divided on some of these cultural issues. And we have, you know, we're the richest country in the world, in the United States of America. There is no reason why we shouldn't have free college tuition for every citizen. You know, it's not fair that young people go to college and then they're saddled with all of this debt that, you know, they can have a hard time even finding a job to pay off the debt that they're saddled with for going to school, getting an education. And there's no reason why we shouldn't have health care for everybody. They have this in Europe. They have this in countries in Latin America. They have it in Cuba. We're the richest country in the world. And so I think sometimes when people use the cultural issues to divide us, it's just a way to take the attention from the real issues are the economic issues. Now we see that our government is going to have to give up $1 trillion or more before this is all over to sustain our economy. Well, you know what? We could have done that before also, given the money so that young people don't have to be saddled with loans after they finish college, and so that everybody could have free health care. I mean, you know, universal health care for everyone. These are things that are attainable, but we can't get that unless we go back to when we started the conference. The first conversation that we started was about activism, about people getting engaged. And we know that if we all engage, if we all pay attention, if we all vote, that we're going to be able to attain these opportunities that are denied us in this country. And so this is why we all have to come together and really get engaged and become activists.
Those really such inspiring words at such a difficult time for so many people. Thank you for that. I'd like to get back to some of your legacy. You gave up so much. You sacrificed so much to make a difference in the lives of others, and that included time with your own children. You know, it takes a certain kind of stoicism that is rare. How do you explain that trait within yourself?
Well, I think it's just being dedicated to a cause, knowing, as I said it before, that you can make a difference. And once I learned how to organize, then I just wanted to go out there and still want to try to organize as many people as I can, just to kind of enlighten them, to give them that you might say it's almost like so that they can recognize their own power, and they have to know that they can change things. And when you do this, it's kind of miraculous, actually, when you see people understand this and to erase the ignorance that we have in our society, because a lot of the hatred that people feel towards others, it's ignorance. They don't understand themselves sometimes where it comes from, maybe the way that they were raised, and they were never really taught, you know, the real history of the United States of America, realizing that we're all one people. And if we can just continue to erase that ignorance, and especially if we can get this into our school books so that, you know, young children from the time that they're in kindergarten, and you know, little kids they don't see color unless it's taught to them. So, but if we can educate our whole society that we are, you know, we are one human beings. I always like to say that one of the things that we have to teach everybody is that we're only one human race, Homo sapiens, and our human race came from Africa. This is where our human race began. We are all descendants of that first person, the first human being, which means that we are all Africans. And I like to say that we're all Africans of different shapes and colors, okay? We have a lot of different nationalities. We have a lot of different cultures, but we are all one human race, Homo sapiens. So if we can understand this, then there's no reason why we should hate each other. And yeah, we can have disagreements, but that doesn't mean it has to be turned into hatred. It doesn't have to be turned into violence. And if all of us work together, then we can make sure that the resources of our world are shared by everyone, so you know, that there's no reason to have people that are homeless or to have, you know, our kids of color that don't get an equitable education. This is we're all in this one world together, and I think when you have that vision and that you can make people understand, then you want to teach teach as many people and touch as many people and organize as many people as possible.
So before we wrap up, I just wanted to check in and see how you are doing and how your family is doing. You mentioned you have a couple of children who work in the healthcare profession. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing well, thank you. Yeah, I am sequestered with one of my daughters and doing a lot of work, like all of us, on Zoom and conference calls. And so we continue working. All of our staff, all of our 45 staff are all working from home. And we had to kind of stop our census work. We had 125 people going door to door. So we had to stop canvassing, but we are working. All of our organizers are doing phone banking now into our hard-to-count communities. So we're continuing our work, but just doing it in a different way.
It's great to hear, and I'm so glad that you're doing well. You know, the word that keeps being used to describe this moment in time is unprecedented. But you have lived through so many moments of uncertainty and change and confusion and fear. Given your life experience, what wisdom do you have for us all as we navigate the upcoming weeks and months as the pandemic plays out?
Well, I know that World War II has been used as a reference in what we're going through right now. And I remember as kids during World War II that we had to partake in the war effort. And the way we partake it is they asked us to gather newspapers, tin cans. And as kids, you know, we thought we were doing something so great just by doing these things that they were asking us to do. And because we knew that somehow we were helping at the war effort. And I think this is what's happening right now. When people, you know, follow the guidelines and they make the sacrifice of staying home and not going out, then you feel like you're part of the effort to try to make sure that this virus does not defeat us as a people and as a society. And so I think that's kind of the spirit that we see right now. And hopefully people will reflect on what's going on right now and to see how, yes, we do need government. And we do need government because this is the way that we can help each other. Because there's been so much, you know, so many people think, oh, we don't need government. Yeah, we do need government. And to remind people that government is us. The government is of the people, you know, by the people and for the people. But the only way that we can make sure that we have good government is that we participate in voting and elections and see what's going on around us. And then also, then we can say, hey, we're glad we pay taxes, because if we didn't pay taxes, we wouldn't have the money that our governments, our state government and our federal government are going to be able to bail us out right now in this time that we're going through. So I think if we can reflect on that and be grateful and be thankful that we do have a democracy in our country and that we do have the institutions that will take care of us, you know, and knowing which institutions have to be shored up, like our health institutions, and why everybody needs universal health care. So I think there's a lot of lessons that are going to be learned. And as we did in World War II, many great things happened after World War II, and I think a lot of great things are going to be happening after this is over here. We will definitely care more about each other. I think we'll be more willing to defend each other and to be individually more responsible.
Well, thank you so much for those optimistic words. And thank you for taking the time to share them with us today. Also, happy birthday.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, and I'm going to be celebrating my birthday on May the 15th. We're going to have an online party, an online celebration with some of our celebrity friends, some of our comedian friends. And we'll be letting you know about that. So people, we'd like to invite people to join us and to let them know about the work that the work that the foundation is doing, our census work, our civic action work, our work that we're doing. And we're also going to be doing a campaign also to build a campus, actually, here in Bakersfield, to have an organizing institute, a child care center, offices, an auditorium, so that we can expand our work and also have a site there, also with a credit union that have a site there where people can come and gather, and we can continue our organizing work that we do.
Wow. Thank you so much for that. We'll definitely keep an eye out for that party. And thank you so much. It's just been an absolute honor to talk with you today.
Thank you. By the way, I just forgot to mention that we also have a big youth organization. We're now, the Dorfetta Foundation, we are now active actually in four counties. In the Valley here, we're in Kern, Tulare, and Fresno counties, and we're doing some work there actually in the Antelope Valley also. And so we have a big youth program also as part of the work that we do. So we continue to expand, and we're also part of the End Child Poverty campaign that we're working on with, we have about 90 organizations in the coalition to end child poverty in California. And so that's one of our big goals also.
Well, you've certainly taken on some of the most pressing issues that the Valley is facing, and I wish you all the best in your continuing work to address all of those issues. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
We've just heard from Dolores Huerta, whose life has inspired countless people, including Maria Hinojosa, host of the NPR show Latino USA. Next week on Valley Edition, we'll have an interview with Hinojosa about the nonprofit media group she founded and her upcoming memoir. During that conversation, I also asked Hinojosa what the legacy of Dolores Huerta means to her. This is what she had to say.
Everything. Everything. I am so lucky that I am one of the people who can say, bueno, she's a friend. She's a friend. I mean, I've interviewed her multiple occasions and, you know, very professional. And she's visited my newsroom and my classrooms. As I'm a professor now at Barnard College here in New York City. But she's someone who I know, and I have seen Dolores. And so when I think of Dolores, she is the person who I have to reach. Like, if I can only be a tiny bit like Dolores at 90 years old, who is still going out there, who is still talking about people power, who is still talking about the fact that she and Cesar Chavez and so many others helped organize the most, again, powerless people in this country, you know, undocumented farm workers in the 1960s and 70s. They made that happen. And as she talks about people power, I will never forget the importance of that. And so when I think of the challenges that we face, and I think of Dolores. She always says this is an organizing opportunity. Now, I'm not an activist. I'm not an organizer. I'm a journalist. But I know that in the work that I do, I'm able to give context to ultimately what she wants, which is she wants people who are awake. She wants people who are awake and engaged in this democracy. And then I also think about, you know, these other parts of Dolores, the fact that she, I mean, I guess it was maybe a decade ago, a little bit less, when we were in a hotel room and she was sharing the hotel room with someone because she wanted to help save money for this nonprofit organization. She was getting ready to get on a 4 a.m. shuttle bus to an airport because she didn't want to take a cab and spend the extra money. She was getting ready to go and party with people, young people, and stay out until 3 o'clock in the morning at bars, dancing. You know, I can't do that. And I'm like, I need to be more like Dolores. So to me, Dolores is, I need to be more like Dolores. And all I can hope is that as I get older, I'm able to hang out and party and continue to be as hopeful and as connected as Dolores Huerta. I love you, Dolores. You are my everything. And I'm so happy that you're celebrating her in the state of California, and we should in the entire country.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. This week, Governor Newsom said that California's stay-at-home directive in response to the COVID-19 pandemic will not be lifted anytime soon. As we adjust to this new normal, the pace of life has slowed, and many of us are using the time to settle into a good book. I spoke to journalist and author Mark Arax, who said that now is the perfect time to discover or revisit the work of the Valley's most famous writer,
William Sororian. I'm curious to hear why you think this is such a fitting time to revisit the works of William Sororian.
So we're all in the middle of this lockdown. And the other night, my son, I think it was close to midnight, and he'd spent much of the day reading Dostoevsky, and he came into my office and I said, hey, let's do some light reading here. So I pulled off my library shelf a book of short stories by Sororian called Little Children. And I started reading out loud the first story, which is titled Laughing Sam. Now, you know, there's a lot of folks who don't know Sororian, and, you know, but he's Fresno's most famous export. I don't know, maybe the raisin's more famous, but, you know, he was one of the most prized writers in the world in the 30s and 40s, right up there with Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Steinbeck and Faulkner. Won a Pulitzer Prize for a play he wrote and an Academy Award from a film adapted from his novel, The Human Comedy. And, you know, today you might call him the most famous forgotten writer of the 20th century. I mean, they don't even teach him in the schools of Fresno Unified. Not long ago, I was at our local Barnes & Noble. I asked for Sororian. They had a single copy of one of his books. So I was reading Laughing Sam to Jake. And, you know, it was a story that made him laugh and then tear up all in the span of five pages. And what he told me kind of, you know, really resonated. He said, you know, I remember reading Sororian as a kid, these same stories, but when you hear his voice again as an adult, it's a completely different experience. It's a voice from above, you know, kind of almost godlike, dare say, simple and yet very profound. And he's writing about mankind. It's tragedy and comedy, madness, genius, folly. And I think it's a voice for what we're going through right now. You know, his stories are often told through the wise eyes of a child. And it allows for a kind of wonderment. And I think this is the perfect time for that voice. The urban roar has kind of become a whisper. And, you know, I think this is a time in our lives where when everything has been kind of reduced to the elemental.
Certainly. I mean, people are riding their bikes again. People are taking long walks again. We're cooking again.
Exactly. I mean, and I'm kind of living for those moments. You know, you live for these moments, the breath of the walk, when the sun's out, the touch of it, the taste of that meal that, hell, I think I've cooked a home meal 26 straight days. It's, you know, so this has become our life. And in a way, we've returned to Sororian time. You know, on my walks, I'm sure on your walks too, you never seen so many kids riding their bikes. And some of them are new at it. They're a bit unsteady. And I'm reminded that, you know, it was from the seat of a bicycle that Sororian discovered the world of Fresno.
Well, you know, tell us a little bit more about him. I mean, you actually knew him when you were younger, correct?
That's right. So he was a friend of my grandfather's who was a kind of poet farmer, my grandpa. And as a teenager and then as a college student, I'd go to his house over there across from Cooper Junior High School on Griffith Way in northwest Fresno. And the lawn was like waist high. And, you know, you looked at it, it looked like a bunch of weeds. But there was actually dandelion that he would harvest and mint that he would harvest. And you knock on the door and there would be this roar, kind of a bellow with a slight lisp that would shout from the kitchen. He's come in, come in. And the tea kettle was whistling. And it was a weird experience being inside there. All around where he wrote were these rocks and pieces of twine and shards of glass that he collected on his bicycle rides through town. And I remember asking him, why rocks? And he said, well, they remind me that art should be above all simple. And then he took me to the windowsill behind this draftsman's table where he wrote standing up on an old Royal typewriter. And there was this tape recorder. And he said, listen. And he turned it on. And he was recording the sound of night. Well, it was just silence, basically. And then, and, you know, after a minute or two, you might hear the buzz of a fly. And so I was telling him, you know, excitedly how I was reading and memorizing new words to use in my own writing. I remember saying once, you know, I was memorizing words like ubiquitous. He did not laugh at me. but he did say, go back to my stories, read the words, count them, 300 words. And I remember him telling me, you should write about what you know in the language that you know it. So lessons that I got as a kid. So I think it's a perfect time to reintroduce or introduce, as the case may be, William Saroyan's voice to the people of this valley during a time when our lives have drawn kind of inward.
And perhaps you could share just a line or two of his writing that you feel really speak to this moment that we're living through.
Yeah, so Saroyan wrote about people who came through genocide only to confront, you know, the Great Depression, the flu pandemic of 1918, World War I, World War II. And, you know, the stories are kind of universal. And, you know, you could hear his voice all the time. I mean, one quote that I really like is, I think it's in the preface to The Time of Your Life, which is the play that he wrote in 6 days that won a Pulitzer. And he's telling us, in the time of your life, live so that in that wondrous time, you shall not add to the misery and sorrow of the world, but shall smile to the infinite delight and mystery of it. Try to learn to breathe deeply, really to taste food when you eat, and when you sleep, really to sleep. Try as much as possible to be wholly alive with all your might, and when you laugh, laugh like hell. And when you get angry, get good and angry. Try to be alive. You will be dead soon enough.
Oh, that's just so beautiful.
It is.
It's so poignant.
Yeah. So it's this voice that I think is rare, that has been forgotten. And it would be neat for all of us to share in this voice during this time when we're kind of locked up, captive. Things have gotten more simple, and I think it's a perfect time for Saroyan.
And I understand you're really actively reaching out to folks and trying to get more attention to Saroyan's work. Can you tell us a little bit about what you have going on?
I always have. In all of my books, each one, I do riffs on Saroyan. Even this last one, The Dreamt Land, which is ostensibly about water and farming and everything else in California. There's Saroyan throughout that book, here and there. And when I was a writer at the LA Times, I did several stories on Saroyan, his archives. You know, Saroyan left behind more cubic yards, I think it is, or cubic feet, however they measure it in library parlance, more archival material, more unpublished manuscripts than any writer of the 20th century, more than Twain, more than Steinbeck, more than all of them. And they're sitting, you know, in this pile somewhere at Stanford. And so it'd be nice to get all these works republished again or published for the first time. And because I think there's a lot of gems in there. I've been able to read some of the unpublished stuff, and it's remarkable. You know, as he was dying, he wrote a 300,000-word manuscript. I think it was called Adios Muchachos, never been published. So it would be neat to see all that come back, to see him come back. You see writers go out of favor. Saroyan went out of favor because the critics thought of him as being too sentimental, maybe even mawkish, but he isn't. You know, he's just writing about those things that are you know, that we confront as humans.
Right. Really, really the human experience.
It is. He would always talk about the human condition. It's the first time I heard those two words together when I was a kid. And that was what he was writing about. And we find ourselves in the middle of a real human condition right now.
Certainly so. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us and to remind us of what a treasure we have in Saroyan's work.
Yeah. Maybe we can do something with that voice. So let's see.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock.
pregnant women are especially impacted by COVID-19, as hospitals are only allowing one person in the birthing room with the mother. FM89's Alice Daniel spoke with 26-year-old Brianna Gaines, who is due today. Gaines is a doula and recently graduated from Fresno State. Here's her perspective.
It's a lot, and it hits you in a different way from the, you know, from the beginning of the pregnancy. You know, I'm like, at the end, it becomes, you know, more real that you're going to have a baby. You feel the movements. You feel all that sort of stuff. You feel Braxton Hicks. You feel, you know, your body, you know, getting ready for birth. So it's, you know, like I said, the stress is amplified. It's already a little nerve-wracking. But then, yeah, dealing with all this stuff and having to be quarantined, and I do my best to try to keep calm. But I'm, like, looking at stuff, like, you know, in the hospitals, you know, women, you know, aren't able to have the support people that they need during labor. And that's, for me, that part is so stressful. I'm like, women need support, you know, during labor. Even if I wasn't a doula, I couldn't imagine, you know, doing a labor, you know, by myself. My first labor, I had the support of my mom and little sister, you know, who were with me, who got to be with me, you know, during that process. So I'm like, I couldn't imagine having to do that alone. I've already gone to the hospital several times in this pregnancy, but the last time, maybe it was about a month ago, I was just having some really bad pelvic girdle pain. It was really hard for me to walk. And we went to the hospital, and, you know, my husband, he couldn't even go with me at all into the hospital. And so that was, to me, a little bit frustrating, because he, you know, has tried to be, you know, super involved in this pregnancy. Like, he's very, very involved in the whole pregnancy. And so that, for me, it was a little unsettling. I'm like, well, what if something happens, or, you know, and he can't be up here? And I was probably in the hospital for about a good 2.5 hours, and he had to sit and wait in the car. And, you know, we were texting, you know, back and forth, because I wasn't in active labor, just having pain. Part of me feels really frustrated at not having enough money to be able to afford, you know, the kind of birth that I want. And I mean, the birth that I want is rarely simple. It's just with a home birth midwife. That's all I really wanted. I don't need, you know, the bells and whistles and all these, you know, super, you know, complex things. It's, to me, it's really, you know, sort of disheartening that Medi-Cal doesn't pay for it. And it just, I guess, even more frustrating myself, because I can't afford it. You know, I'm just like, well, we could, you know, have spent the money on that, but then that means, you know, you can't pay your rent or, you know, food or that sort of stuff. So it's just, it doesn't seem like a smart option. Last week, my uncle just died of COVID-19. He lives in Washington, and it was really, honestly, it was really sudden. And I feel like that's what started to really solidify my worrying, because he was fine. And then he started showing symptoms, and he got really sick. And then, you know, he was in ICU, and I'm like, and he died by himself. Oh, wow. It becomes more real when, you know, it happens to someone that's close to you.
That was 26-year-old Brianna Gaines talking about what it's like to have a baby due during this pandemic. And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all of this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You could also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Laura Satsui, and Madi Bolaños. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, standing with all Californians as we address the coronavirus emergency together, on the web at chcf.org.